The following program is a special presentation of The Voice of America.
It's been a long way, but we're here.
It had been a long way. For my traveling companion, Ed Mitchell, the journey to the moon had begun only a few days before, inside a spacecraft that took off atop the mightiest rocket of all time from pad number 39A at Cape Kennedy. But as far as I was concerned, the journey had really begun 10 years before, inside a capsule perched atop a rocket that by today's standards looks like a child's toy. A rocket that took off from pad number 5 at what we then called Cape Canaveral in the morning of May 5th, 1961.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
In observance of the 10th anniversary of the first flight into space by an American, the flight of Freedom 7 of May 5th, 1961, the Voice of America presents The Long Way from Pad Number 5, a recollection of the flight by the man who undertook it, astronaut Alan B. Shepard, Jr.
There was a lot less vibration and noise than I had expected. It was extremely smooth, a subtle, gentle, gradual rise off the ground. There was nothing rough or abrupt about it. But there was no question that I was going either. I could see it on the instruments, hear it on the headphones, feel it all around me. It was a strange and exciting sensation. And yet it was so mild and easy, so much like the rides we had experienced in our trainers, that it somehow seemed familiar. I felt as if I had experienced the whole thing before. Yet nothing could possibly simulate in every detail the real thing that I was going through at that moment. The butterflies in my stomach. And I'd be less than honest if I didn't admit I'd had some before the flight started. We're all gone by then. There simply was no time for butterflies. In front of my eyes, a myriad of small green lights flickered on the instrument panel like a flight of fireflies. Pointers rose mutely under glass dials, and over the headphones, the voice of Deke Slayton kept acknowledging the receipt of my messages.
This is Freedom 7. The fuel is go, 1.2G, cabin at 14 PSI. Oxygen is go.
As in a stand, detect the AOP.
It had all the makings of a textbook flight. So, in effect, there was no reason for butterflies. But just about an hour before, after they closed the hatch of the capsule, the butterflies in my stomach had been pretty strong. But even then I thought, okay, Buster, you volunteered for this thing. Now it's up to you to do it. I volunteered for the astronaut program for several reasons, but I guess the strongest was an urge to pioneer. I grew up in a small town, so small, in fact, that you may not even be able to find it on your map. East Derry, New Hampshire, where my father, a retired Army colonel, is now an insurance broker. I grew up, if not exactly in an atmosphere of aviation, at least in the midst of mechanical things. And if you happen to bring up the subject in the presence of my mother, Mrs. Alan Shepard, Sr., she'll tell you that I was attracted to flying from childhood.
When he was about 12 years old, we took a flight from Manchester to Boston and back. And that, of course, was a very short trip, but he was very much interested in it. And following that, he wanted to go up to the Manchester Quinia Field, and he would hitchhike up there just to have a chance to look at the planes. And then a little later on, he earned money enough to get a bicycle to ride up. And, of course, they could learn so much from just watching and looking. And he also offered to sweep out the airplane base if they would let him stay and look at them and watch them.
By the time I was 17, I had made up my mind to become a flyer. I applied for and was admitted to the United States Naval Academy at Annapolis and graduated in 1944. At that time, the Navy had a rule that even prospective flyers had to go to sea first. So I spent some time on a destroyer in the Pacific during the last year of World War II. After the war ended, I went to flight school, and in 1947, I received my wings. Then in 1950, I was lucky enough to be chosen to attend the Navy Test Pilot School at Patuxent River, Maryland. For the next few years, I helped perfect several advanced Navy aircraft. Then I went to the Naval War College to brush up on some academic subjects. And after that, I became a staff officer at the Atlantic Fleet headquarters in Norfolk, Virginia. I thought I had a very good chance of becoming the skipper of a carrier squadron in another year or so and going back to sea. But it didn't work out that way, because by then the United States had reached the decision to begin its manned exploration program of outer space.
The first step was the decision that this nation's first venture into manned space flight should be a peaceful civilian effort.
This is Robert Purser, in those days, special assistant to the director of Project Mercury, as that first venture into spaceflight had been named.
The next step was to determine which group would handle it. NASA was chosen as that group. Then plans were made, remade, gone over, studied, to decide just what the program should be. It was decided that the program should be the simplest possible undertaking to make an absolute minimum of new developments in order to achieve the program as rapidly as was reasonable and with the highest reliability that was possible.
2 achieve that reliability, thousands of people, scientists, technicians, engineers, all kinds of specialists, went to work in factories, laboratories, and offices all over these United States. What you must remember is that this was a project without precedent.
You realize there just wasn't a handbook you went to look up spaceship and you say, here's the way you build it.
And this is the man who was put in charge of that gigantic effort, Robert Gilruth, who was the director of Project Mercury.
Nobody had ever built a spaceship before, and as a matter of fact, at that time, no one had ever re-entered anything back from orbit and brought it back safely.
So some of those thousands of specialists went to work to design the spaceship. Others started to look into the booster, the rocket which would lift this spaceship into an orbit of the Earth. Still another group began to examine the problems connected with the man who would fly inside that spaceship, to ensure that his safety would be ensured. The question of the booster was solved first. For the orbital flights, the Atlas, at that time America's most powerful rocket, would be used. But before such orbital flights, there would be training flights in a ballistic path, short flights that would follow the trajectory of a rocket. For these flights, the NASA scientists chose the Redstone, 23 meters tall, liquid-fueled ballistic missile.
The Redstone booster had already achieved a significant record of reliability flight.
This is Jack Heberlig, at that time technical assistant to the director of Project Mercury.
Of over 40 Redstone launches, only two boosters have failed. However, the Mercury spacecraft escape system would have prevented the astronaut from being harmed in such a malfunction.
Meanwhile, the spacecraft was in the process of being designed. It would have to be a vehicle that could withstand the strain of space travel while protecting the man inside from that strain. It would have to contain all the instruments necessary to enable a man inside to actually fly it while being light enough to be taken into space by the Redstone rocket. The designers of McDonnell Aircraft came up with a design which was eventually accepted. It would be a cone-shaped vehicle measuring about 2 meters across the base and 3 meters from top to bottom. The man who would ride this spacecraft would have about the same amount of room as a pilot in a fighter plane cockpit, only a lot more instruments to watch.
The instrument panel in front of the astronaut is grouped as to functions.
This is Max Faget, the man credited with the final design of the Mercury spacecraft. He is here describing it for the press as it was finished.
The group on the left side is concerned with the position, control, retro rockets, decompression, and repressurization. Decompression could be used to extinguish a fire. Next to these is a sequence display, a series of lights indicating whether various functions occurred at the proper time. A green light means proper functioning, a red light improper. Shown next are the dials for flight instruments, for acceleration, rate of descent, altitude, and control fuel supply. The top center panel shows position with respect to the Earth in terms of pitch, roll, and yaw. In event of automatic control failure, the astronaut can again control his own attitude, aided by a periscope below the panel and by a window above. From the window, he can see the horizon back of the capsule, and through the periscope, he has a view of the Earth. In the upper right of the panel is the environmental control system, cabin pressure and temperature, suit pressure and temperature.
The designers of McDonnell Aircraft had indeed thought of everything, but that still was not enough for the NASA scientists. Suppose the instruments that control the pressure and the temperature inside the cabin failed. What then? What would happen to the man inside? He would simply explode, one scientist said bluntly. The man would have to be provided, therefore, with another shield. It came in the form of a special suit, a pressure suit, much like those that pilots were already wearing for high altitude and high speed flights. It consisted of a hard white helmet with a visor and a rubber suit, light and flexible, with a silver outer coating to keep the man cool at all times. It was also outfitted with some hoses or lines carrying air or oxygen inside, the equipment necessary to keep man from exploding should all the instruments inside the cabin fail. The rocket, the spacecraft, the suit were either ready or on the way to be readied. Then came what was regarded as the biggest obstacle to be surmounted yet, the human element. Who would fly the spacecraft? A team of scientists established the criteria for the future spaceman. He must be under 40 years old, height about 1.70 meters. He must have a college degree in engineering or physical science. He must have graduated from test pilot school and have logged at least 1,500 flight hours. Of the thousands of military aviators in this country, only 110 men met the initial criteria. And of these 110, only 7 were finally selected to become the first American astronauts. I was lucky enough to be one of them.
Donald K. Slayton.
Alan B. Shepard.
Walter M. Sherrod.
Virgil I. Grissom.
John Glenn.
Leroy G. Cooper, Jr.
Malcolm Scott Carpenter.
I had read about the program in the papers before I heard anything about it officially. NASA had published the requirements of the astronauts it was looking for, and I knew that I was qualified on all counts. I assumed they would probably be looking me up and asking me if I was interested. As it turned out, they were doing just that. But the orders got misplaced somewhere, and I was beginning to wonder if I had been overlooked or disqualified. The orders finally came, asking me to report for the first briefing, and I was delighted. I had a long talk with my wife that night, discussing what I should do if I were selected. Finally, Louise said, "Why are you asking me? You know you'll do it anyway." What I and the other six astronauts did for the next few months was train, train, and train again. And when we thought we had trained enough, we kept on training. We were based at Langley Field in Virginia, where the working day was divided into two parts. In the morning, we took high-level courses in basic astronautics, the physical laws of spaceflight, propulsion systems, guidance systems, electronic systems, launch and operational procedures, and the physiology of flight, both atmospheric and spaceflight. In the afternoon, we kept up our flight proficiency, working on simulators. We also exercised. We had self-study programs to get acquainted with every aspect of spaceflight in general and with Project Mercury in particular. We had weightless flying and centrifuge training to get acquainted with the void in which we would operate and the brutal force of acceleration. We visited the factories where the hardware, the rockets, and the spaceships were being manufactured. We watched recovery operations aboard ships, practiced eating and drinking in a weightless state, and trained for survival under adverse conditions. By the beginning of April 1961, everything was ready. We knew that the Russians were also getting ready, but what we didn't know was just how ready they were. On April 12, 1961, we found out. Yuri Gagarin was flying in an orbit around the Earth. We were somewhat disappointed, of course, that the first man to cross that imaginary line that separates the atmosphere of the Earth from the cosmos had not been an American. But we were not heartbroken. We never felt we were in a race with the Russians. We had a job to do, and we would attempt to do it on May 2nd, 1961. I honestly was never sure that I would be the first man to ride the Mercury capsule. I knew I had done well in the tests and simulator rides, but I figured one of the others would probably go first. I got the word that I had been selected in the combination office and classroom at Langley, where we had listened to so many of our lectures and had done a lot of our homework. There was no hemming or hawing around. Bob Gilruth, the director of Project Mercury, simply announced the choice of a pilot and a backup pilot. The flight would go on May 2nd. On the morning of May 2nd, a heavy rain was falling and flashes of lightning were playing around the launch pad. At 1 o'clock in the morning, when I was awakened, Mission Control was still hoping that the rainstorm would pass by 7, when we were scheduled to lift off. So I arose, ate breakfast, suited up, and prepared to set out for the launching pad. I never got there. The rain never stopped, and the mission was scrubbed. It was rescheduled for May 5th. The day before, the weather forecast was good, and when I went to bed, everything was go. I fell asleep in a matter of minutes. There were no dreams or nightmares or tossing in bed. I woke up only once, around midnight, went to the window to check on the stars. I could see them, so I went back to sleep. A little after 1 o'clock in the morning, I got up, shaved, and showered, and had breakfast with the backup pilot, John Glenn, and Dr. Bill Douglas, our physician. The medical exam and dressing went according to schedule, and we headed for pad number 5. At 5:20 a.m., I disconnected the hose which led to my portable air conditioner, slipped off the protective galoshes that had covered my boots, and squeezed through the hatch. Then at 6:10, the hatch went on, and I was alone. This was the big moment, and I had thought about it a great deal. The butterflies were pretty strong now. Okay, Buster, I said to myself, you volunteered for this thing. Now it's up to you to do it. There was no question in my mind that we were going, unless some serious malfunction occurred. But as the various people concerned with the flight began to check where things stood, everything looked good.
Cameras and tape off.
ECS, free on off.
Free on off.
The gantry that stood next to the rocket rolled back at 6:34, and I lay on my back some 20 meters above the ground, checking the straps and switches and waiting for the countdown to proceed.
94.
Sequence recorders.
Roger.
Telemeter hangar D.
Fuel and quantity indicator.
6-7%.
Emergency oxygen.
100% plus.
I passed some of the time looking through the periscope. The view was fascinating. I could see clouds up above and people far beneath me on the ground. When the sun rose, it came right into the scope, and I had to crank in some filters to cut down the glare. I continued to feel fine. The doctors could tell how I was doing by looking at their instrument panels and talking it over with me.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5.
I think I braced myself a bit too much while Deke Slayton was giving me the final count. Nobody knew, of course, how much shock and vibration I would really feel when I took off. There was no one around who had tried it and could tell me, and we had not heard from Moscow how it felt. I was probably a little too tense, but I was really exhilarated.
3, 2, 1, 0.
All right, lift off, and the clock has started.
It went by the book. I had been well briefed on what to expect, and I had some idea of the huge variety of color and land masses and cloud cover, which I could see from 160 kilometers up. But no one could be briefed well enough to be completely prepared for the astonishing view that I got.
On the periscope, what a beautiful view.
My exclamation back to Deke about the beautiful view was completely spontaneous. It was breathtaking.
Cloud cover over Florida, 3 to 4 tenths near the eastern coast. Obscures up through Hatteras. I can see Okeechobee. I identify Andros Island. Identify the reefs.
The colors around these ocean islands were brilliantly clear, and I could see sharp variations between the blue water and the light green of the shoal areas near the reefs. It was really stunning. All through this period, the capsule and I remained weightless. And though we had a lot of free advice on how this would feel, some of it rather dire, the sensation was just what I expected it would be: pleasant and relaxing. It had absolutely no effect on my movements or my efficiency. I was completely comfortable, and it was something of a relief not to feel the pressure and weight of my body against the couch.
Control is smooth. Retro 1. Very smooth. Retro 2. Retro 3. All three retros are fired. We're switching fly-by-wire. Periscope is retracting. I'm on fly-by-wire going to re-entry attitude.
Projector is right on the button.
Okay, Buster, re-entry attitude. Okay, this is Freedom 7.
It was over in a matter of minutes, just about 15. The capsule hit the water a little abruptly, and then it flopped over on its side, so that I was leaning over on my right side in the couch. I hit the switch to kick the reserve parachute loose and help it right itself. I took off my lap belt and loosened my helmet so I could take it off quickly when I went out the door. And I had just started to make a final reading on all of the instruments when the helicopter pilot called me. Less than 10 minutes later, I was on the deck of the carrier. When we approached the ship, I could see sailors crowding the deck, applauding and cheering and waving their caps. I felt a real lump in my throat. After we landed, I started for the quarters where the doctors would give me a quick once-over before I flew on to Grand Bahama Island for a full debriefing. First, however, I went back to the capsule, which had been lowered gently on a pile of mattresses on the carrier deck. I wanted to retrieve the helmet I had left behind in the cockpit, and I wanted to take one more look at Freedom 7. I was pretty proud of the job that it had done, too.
10, 9, 8, ignition sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Launch commit. Liftoff. We have liftoff with Apollo 14. 3 minutes past the hour. The tower is clear.
Houston is controlling. 16 seconds. Pitch and roll program started. 14 maneuvering to a proper flight course.
That was 10 years later, almost to the day, as Ed Mitchell, Steve Russo, and I started for the moon. 10 long years. For a while, I had been grounded because of a problem in one of my ears. But an operation had restored me to flight status, and I was now on my way to the moon. No butterflies this time. Just a few thoughts back to the beginning of a journey that for me had really started on pad number 5 at Cape Canaveral 10 years before. A journey that ended a couple of days later on Fra Mauro as I stepped out of the spaceship and Terry's.
And it's been a long way, but we're here.
You have heard The Long Way from Pad Number 5, a recollection of the flight of Freedom 7 by the man who undertook it 10 years ago, astronaut Alan B. Shepard, Jr. The Long Way from Pad Number 5 was produced and directed by Michael Hanu and was recorded in the VOA studios in Washington, D.C., Langley Field, Virginia, and the Manned Space Flight Center in Houston, Texas. Music selected by Eugene Dreyer. Studio technicians, Shirley Walsh and John Morgan. This is Jack Weitzel speaking. We'll be right back.
Yeah.